Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much suffering did early Christians endure in order to practice and proclaim their faith? Stories of early Christian martyrs attacked, imprisoned, even killed by Roman tormentors are an important part of church tradition even today, and countless Christians have been inspired down through the centuries by those willing to die rather than forsake their loyalty to the teachings of Jesus. But what if those stories were not entirely true? Candida Moss is professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame, and her research has revealed that many martyr stories appear to have been exaggerated or even fabricated by early Christian leaders looking for ways to unify believers, fight heresy, and engender financial support. She writes about what she's learned in her new book, The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Candida, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So you cite a study by an Italian scholar who estimates 70 million Christians have died for their beliefs over the past two millennia. What sorts of individuals are included in a figure like that?
Well, it's a very big figure. And so, of course, he's including Christians who died in wars, and such as Christians who died as part of the Holocaust. He's including Christians who die as part of all through the Reformation. It's a lot of people. That's a huge figure.
So for purposes of this research, how did you define martyrdom?
Well, I think that it's really important to think about persecution, which is what I'm really interested in, as resulting from a sort of deliberate, targeted attack, that you're deliberately trying to seek out that group of people and harm them. And that's going to be distinguished from people who die violently and tragically, but as a result of initiatives or wars or laws that are really not about harming them.
So how did you become interested in taking a critical look at the martyrdom tradition in Christianity?
Well, I've been working on martyrs for over a decade. This is, in fact, my third book on early Christian history and martyrdom. But I realized that my students, they still thought that Christians were constantly persecuted. And I began to hear more and more discussion by political leaders, by religious leaders, by media pundits about how Christians are being persecuted today. And oftentimes they would refer to the persecution in the early church. So Bishop Jenke, who's the Bishop of Indiana, got a lot of press for saying that President Obama was persecuting Christians just like the Roman emperors and Hitler and Stalin. And I thought to myself, he's referring to this history of persecution, and he's referring to the idea that Christians are constantly persecuted, but they haven't been. And so much of that idea rests on the history of the early church.
Was there a significant value placed on martyrdom in the broader culture of the Middle East before the crucifixion of Jesus?
Yes, there was. And this is another sort of misconception people have. We tend to think that Christianity was totally new when they talked about martyrdom and valuing death for a cause. But in fact, everyone in the ancient world thought that you should, if possible, die for something better than yourself. So Achilles, who died in the Trojan War, he chose to die at Troy. This young soldier chose to die at Troy, to die this glorious death in preference to a long life. And in exchange, he knew that he would be remembered for that, and he has been. And this was sort of very common in the ancient world. Everyone thought that the honorable thing to do was to embrace death for country or city or God.
As opposed to the way we look at a good death today, which is something sort of peaceful and at the very end of a long life.
That's right. Now everyone wants to die in bed at the end of a long life, painlessly, hopefully surrounded by friends and family.
So what did early Christians in particular believe about the sort of special place that a martyr would hold in the eyes of God?
Well, a lot of this comes from the death of Jesus. Christianity was utterly unique in having a leader, a savior figure, who was crucified, who was killed in this barbaric way. And that really changed the way the early Christians thought about persecution and martyrdom. They decided that this was now the ideal, something you should aspire to. And in trying to sort of do what Jesus would do, they thought, well, in this situation, Jesus would die. And so it really became a sort of a center point of Christianity. And it got sort of hardwired into the Christian psyche. Now, what it means to be a Christian is to embrace suffering like Jesus and to fight persecution.
Yeah, so it's really the ultimate way to be like Jesus.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And in certain circumstances, I think we would all say that there are things that we would die for, principles or ideals that we would die for. But what Christians also said was that their deaths came as a result of sort of demonically inspired persecution. So they were in a war. It was us versus them, good versus evil, and they're on the side of good. And that's part of this martyrdom mythology that has been inherited today. So when people today talk about persecution, they're saying that there are other people out there who are persecutors, who are trying to harm them. And that's what's dangerous about this. Then you're saying that there are people out there who are in league with Satan. And no one has a conversation with Satan. And no one advocates for human rights for demons.
And one of your concerns about that is that it ultimately can look like a justification for aggression against non-Christians, by Christians.
That's right. You know, if you're persecuted, you're on the defensive. And we, pretty much everyone agrees that if you're under attack, you're morally entitled to defend yourself. You know, we don't say, oh, you should just let people come and kill you. So when you have a powerful group saying that they're on the defensive, they're under attack, they're being persecuted, that powerful group can justify all kinds of violence against others on the basis that they're acting in self-defense. And that's what persecution language does.
So ultimately, Candida, this boils down to the study of ancient history. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges of verifying the stories of the early martyrs?
Right. Well, you know, there used to be thousands of stories that people thought were authentic. And it began in the Reformation when Luther pointed out how could there be more than 12 apostles buried in Germany alone. And so there were all of these fraudulent texts, and both Protestants and Catholics worked at trying to sort of cut out the clear forgeries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you have a text that refers to an idea or an event that happened hundreds of years after the events that it purports to describe, you know that something's awry. So when we look at these texts, and you can really see this when you look at the evidence, you can see people changing details. You can see people altering stories and inserting in their own agendas into these texts. And that's very clear when you look at them. When you see someone who is clearly being portrayed as being like Christ, and all of the details of the story match up to the Christ story, even the captain of the guard is called Herod, then you know that something's a little amiss with that story.
A little too perfect.
It's a little too perfect.
So yeah. What were you able to verify?
Well, there definitely were persecution. Very briefly, from 303 to 305, there was a law that was passed that wasn't about Christians, but that led Christians to die in 250. And there was, very briefly, for a couple of months, some legislation kicking Christians out of office in 257 to 258. But what's interesting when you look at this material is that when Romans start saying we need to do something about the Christians, the first thing they do is they have to kick the Christians out of public office. Which leads us to believe that Christians were really flourishing. Now, did Christians die during this period? Yeah, they did. But often when they were dying for political reasons because the Romans didn't understand Christianity, or the Christians would say things that sounded like political subversion. And when we think about the Roman Empire, we have to look at what Romans are doing to Christians in context. And this is a period in time in which you could be executed for adultery, you could be executed for arson, you could be executed for bearing false witness in a courtroom, you could be executed for writing and singing a satirical song. So, you know, John Stewart would have been executed in this world. So if you think about that world, then you can imagine that political revolutionaries were also executed. So we have to sort of place what happens to Christians in that context.
So in terms of the records that were kept by the Romans that survived to today, are there notations that say this person is being executed because of Christianity, or are there references to Christian beliefs in those documents?
Right. Okay. So we have various pieces of evidence that are never take issue with Christian beliefs. Mm-hmm. So they never say, this Trinity is stupid, let's kill them. When they, our first discussion comes in the beginning of the second century, this Roman governor called Pliny writes to the emperor, who is Trajan, and he says, what am I supposed to do about these Christians? And he says that what he finds really frustrating about the Christians is their contempt of court and their obstinacy. And that seems to be Pliny's motivation here. This is why he doesn't like them. And he says that he's executing them, which the Romans did for lots of things. And Trajan had already made secret groups illegal. So he didn't like people meeting in secret because he worried that would lead to rebellion. So Christians looked a lot like that. And Pliny describes Christians as a superstition. So he doesn't actually think they're a religious group. And Trajan writes back to Pliny and he says, you're right, execute them if they're doing this. He says, don't seek them out. He says, don't go and find Christians. Trajan basically puts the most minimal requirements into law. So he could have issued a law saying Christians should be killed. He doesn't do that. He just replies to Pliny's letter. And that's really interesting. So there was no legislation in place, but Christians could find themselves executed. And it seems to be that the motivation there was that they were obstinate and that they were defiant. In the 19th century, we discovered some legislation from the Romans. We discovered Roman documentation from the period of 250. And in 250, the new emperor Decius issued a decree that everyone had to go and participate in the Roman imperial cult. And to us, we might say, well, obviously Christians can't do that. But at the time, no one had ever protested that before. So the Romans saw participating in this imperial cult as a political decision. Our Christian records have always said that these were wicked decrees looking to get the Christians. They've always said this was persecution and that Decius was trying to harm the Christians. And we have all of these stories about this period. But when we discovered this actual Roman legislation, it became clear that this was just a universal decree. And some of these documents actually mention priestesses of Isis participating. So what you have is you have priestesses of pagan deities participating in this decree, which proves this isn't about Christians. So Christians died, but the Romans weren't interested in the Christians, which is what Christian history has always said. Christian history has always said that the Romans were out to get the Christians. And it seems as if they weren't seeking them out, and that some of the legislation wasn't even about Christianity.
So for the pre-Christian Romans, these sort of compulsory cult practices were a political tool, a tool of control of the population?
Yeah, well, they were. It was about unity. It's really hard to control the Roman Empire. And the Romans were fine with you maintaining your religious traditions as long as you would participate in this Roman imperial cult, which is a lot like an ideological tax or something. It's like a pledge of allegiance in the ancient world. And when Christians said they wouldn't do that, the Romans had never heard that before. No one had ever said, I can't also participate in the Roman imperial cult. And the way the Christians said it, they said, we can't show respect to the emperors. We can only respect Christ. And so the Romans, the Christians are dissenting, could potentially harm the empire by refusing to participate in this ritual. And they just had never heard of this before. Why wouldn't you be able to respect the emperor?
Candida Moss is my guest. She's professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. Her new book is called The Myth of Persecution, How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Candida Moss. She is professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. Her new book is called The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Candida, I'm curious about this. We've heard many stories down through the years of Christians worshiping in secret, sort of away in the catacombs, because they were afraid of even being discovered as Christians. Can you address what you learned about that?
Yeah, that idea actually comes from the 19th century when we really started to discover the catacombs and people started to think maybe they met here in secret, and it really propelled the tourist industry in Rome at the time. We know that they weren't in secret. So the Emperor Diocletian, who started the first real period of persecution that matches up to our conception of what persecution looks like, the first thing he did was he tore down a church that was erected opposite his palace. Now, that's the very opposite of being in hiding. You know, when you're building a church sort of in the emperor's face, literally, you're clearly not in hiding or persecuted. The fact that both Diocletian and Valerian, who are the only two Roman emperors who really speak to targeting Christians, the fact that they begin their reforms with, we need to get the Christians out of the Roman Senate, we need to get them out of the Roman Emperor's household, indicates that Christians were openly Christian in the actual household of the Roman Emperor himself. I mean, imagine that. They're very far from in hiding. Christians weren't hiding. People knew who they were.
So how pervasive was Christianity among the broader population?
Yeah, I mean, they were growing in this period. So in the first century, they're a very small group, completely under the radar. No one really knows who they are. And they themselves call themselves Jews. So no one's really targeting them in the first century. And they start to grow, and they are successful. There are quite a few of them, and they're building churches in the late 3rd century in full view of the Roman authorities. So they are spreading and growing, perhaps not as quickly as people think that they were, but they really are a booming group.
And one of the problems they had to solve was the idea that there were sort of different factions of Christianity, different sects, and there was the question of what they would agree on besides, embracing the teachings of Jesus.
Right. There are lots of different sort of brands of Christianity. And in fact, some early Christians didn't think martyrdom was necessary. They thought that you could just go into the Roman court and offer sacrifice if asked to do so. But more importantly, there were lots of different groups advocating for who should be the bishop or what the precise Christian traditions were. And what's interesting is how, in sort of writing martyrdom stories, later historians were able to sort of combat heresy. You know, so you could try and make a logical argument about why a heretical position was wrong, or you could tell a story in which a famous martyr, whom everyone regarded highly, had once denounced the leader of that heretical group. It's sort of like when people today will say, well, George Washington would have said X.
Right.
Except that what people were doing in the early church was they were forging documents in which George Washington actually said X. You know, so George Washington thought that marriage was only between a man and a woman. That would be a very powerful document if we discovered it. And that's sort of what early Christians were doing in order to sort of combat heresy or schismatics or various forms of Christianity that they disagreed with.
And then, as now, those were simply, they were inspirational stories, right?
They were. They were inspirational stories. These are tales of courage and heroism, of standing for what you believe in, no matter what. And a lot of these stories, when you read them, and people should read them, are stories about young women or about slaves. And these are really stories that were countercultural to the extent that they challenged the ancient social hierarchy. Women and slaves and people who were from the lowest social groups, they could really excel in the eyes of God by becoming martyrs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Colin in Dallas. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for, Mr. Moss, thanks for just dialoguing on the show. I've enjoyed it so far.
Welcome.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I have a question, or maybe just a comment that you can kind of dialogue with me on. As far as what I hear about early church, early Christianity, and the idea of suffering, to me, I hear you keep referring to 200, 300 AD, but like when I see the biblical understanding of suffering from 1 Peter saying, hey, I don't want you to suffer just because you're an idiot, but hey, if the gospel caused you to suffer, then suffer. Even 1 Peter says, hey, honor the emperor, all these kind of themes that you see. And then you see Claudius in 58 or 54, he's an emperor, and he's nice to the Jews. And then you have Nero, who burns Rome and blames it on Christians. Then you have Domitian. When we talk about early, early church, going back to even late 100 A.D., comment on that, because that's a definite different understanding of suffering than what you're mentioning later on, 200, 300.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you. These are great questions. Yeah, absolutely. Christianity is really shot through and through with the idea of you should suffer like Christ if that situation arises. So what to say about Nero first? Because you're right, Claudius is, you know, acting with respect to the Jews. But Nero, this is the story everyone hears, that he blamed the Jews. Now, our source for that story is Tacitus, who's writing in the 2nd century. And what's interesting about Tacitus is that Tacitus hates Nero and wants to show him in the worst possible light. And Tacitus tells us that Nero blamed the Christians, who were this unpopular group, because of abominations they were supposed to have practiced. But what's interesting is in 64, when this great fire happened, Christians don't call themselves Christians yet. There's just no evidence of that. So our evidence for Christians calling themselves Christians comes from texts that were written later. So you mentioned 1 Peter. That's at the end of the first century. And so the interesting thing is Tacitus retrojecting back into the time of Nero the idea that Christians were hated? And it seems to me and to other historians that perhaps he was, that he's basically saying, well, Christians are hated now. I'm going to have Nero blaming the Christians as part of my portrayal of Nero as a bad emperor. I think that Christians probably felt very persecuted. You know, these followers of Jesus, they probably felt very marginalized. They felt like they were a small group. They felt that they were at risk from the Roman Empire. But whether or not the Roman Empire even knew who Christians were in the first century, it seems to me that they didn't. And when we read even stories about the Christians who were supposed to have died in the first century, so the apostles, those stories don't even mention things like the fire of Rome. They don't mention the persecution of Christians as Christians. The apostles die as a result of sort of rivalries between Christians and other religious workers, and because they do things that are unpopular. So Peter, for example, he persuades the concubines of Agrippa to start living in chastity and to stop having sex with him. And that's what sort of leads to Peter's death. And that's one way to draw attention to yourself. But he doesn't die as a Christian. And I think that's really important.
What changed when Constantine was converted to Christianity?
Well, what changed was that Christians now were sort of in control. Constantine makes Christianity a state-sponsored religion. And what's interesting is that the experience of suffering and persecution, that certainly hadn't taught the Christians to be tolerant. So we have stories of Christians going out and destroying pagan temples. And in fact, Constantine had to stop them doing this. And when they went and destroyed pagan temples, they thought that if they died in that process, they would die as martyrs. So even now that they're the aggressors, they're going out and destroying temples and killing people, they still see themselves as being on the defensive. They're reacting to the pagans, even though what they're doing is clearly an unprecipitated attack.
How were these stories passed down through the generations, starting, I suppose, around the time of Constantine and on into the future?
Right. Well, at first they circulate orally. So you have a story of someone locally who died, and obviously those stories can grow. They sort of mushroomed. And then scribes started to write them down to support the tourist industry and to support the cult of the saints. And sometimes, you know, there was a lot of pressure to write down these stories. So sometimes they would just sort of copy parts from other stories. We can see that, what we would in the modern world call plagiarism, in the Acts of the Martyrs. And you get essentially the same story, just with a different martyr's name inserted. And we can see people adding on to the legends. And because they become so important for Christianity, we just see this kind of explosion in literature. And explosion in churches dedicated to saints. And so that's how they were passed on. And it led to a lot of mistakes. So there are saints that never existed, like St. Christopher. There was, in France for a while, a greyhound who was regarded as a martyr because he was killed by his master for defending a baby. And in one instance, the story of the Buddha makes it into Christian tradition under the name St. Josephat. So there was a lot of error in this process because people loved martyrs.
I mean, was this done really deliberately? Was this done by people who meant well and simply got their facts wrong before, you know, modern history and journalism?
Definitely the latter. Most people meant well. They thought what they were doing was in keeping with what the Holy Spirit wanted them to do.
Mm-hmm.
They really were well-intentioned. They didn't have the standards of history that we have now. And I think the same is the case now. I think when people say that they're persecuted, they probably really believe it. And they really want to sort of help their group out. The problem is when it comes to the history, and this is what's key, is that when you take that history and you bring it into the present and you define Christians as a persecuted group, then you're creating this polarized view of the world. We need to get our facts straight.
Why has this not been more critically examined in the past?
Well, this is what is interesting. Parts of it have been critically examined. So people have been saying this for centuries. They said, you know, maybe we've exaggerated the persecution in the early church. But people who have said this, historians who have been writing, have never managed to sort of get that message out to people. I still have students who say that they're being persecuted, that Christians have always been persecuted. And so we really need to sort of change the way people think about this.
Did these stories, it makes sense, Candida, that in the days of early Christianity as today, these stories would inspire people and help to sort of solidify their faith. Did they win converts when you're telling stories about how the best Christians are the ones who die violently? That would seem to be a turnoff.
Yeah. They did. Yeah, they did win converts. People hear these stories even today, and they're inspired. And people will say this. They'll say, well, why would the apostles have been willing to die for Christ if he hadn't really been resurrected from the dead? Nowadays, that argument holds less sway because we know that people will die for all number of things. You know, we see martyrs from other religious groups. But at the time, and in some communities to this day, this is very persuasive. People are willing to give up their lives for that. How can this religion not be true?
You found examples of Christians, early Christians, who might, in fact, have courted martyrdom.
That's right. And this is really before Christianity starts to outlaw suicide. We have stories of Christians going and volunteering to die, sometimes in their thousands. And it's not just the case that these are sort of fringe groups in Christianity. Some of the most revered, cherished early Christian writers who are seen as sort of the founding blocks of early Christianity, they describe Christians as doing this, as going and volunteering to die. And what's interesting is that these early church writers, when you look at what they actually say, they're not condemning Christians for doing this. They don't see a problem with volunteering to die. And it's important that we know this because sometimes now modern Christians will say, well, Christians would never volunteer to die. That would be suicide. They would never do that. And that's not true. When you look at the evidence, they did volunteer.
So would the Romans before Constantine have said, great, in with the lions? I mean, how did they take these requests?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have this one story about this happening in Asia Minor or modern-day Turkey of thousands of Christians asking a particular Roman governor to kill them. And he's obviously exasperated. And he says to them, if you want to die, you have ropes to hang yourself with.
And as Christians began to come together, how were specific saints sort of chosen to be the standard bearers for the traditions of martyrdom as defined by the church?
Right. Well, it's interesting. So a lot of the stories sort of, they were very popular locally, and so that's why they were chosen. They were very popular local saints. But what would happen is if there was a problem with the story, so for example, if it seemed like the saint had sort of a shady background, mm-hmm. or if they were advocating for religious positions that were no longer in keeping with orthodoxy, those things could be changed. You could edit the text. It would be like doing a kind of textual plastic surgery. Mm-hmm. So you can see that something's been done afterwards, but you don't really know what was there before. And this is the thing about martyrs, is that they're dead. They don't get to speak for themselves. The people who speak for martyrs are the leaders of the church, or the people writing down their stories. So it was easy to control the martyrs, because they could decide what the martyrs would and would not think.
Were the people ultimately recognized as martyrs sort of initially recognized as such immediately, or was this something that would happen decades later? Someone would say, hey, I remember a story about so-and-so, and I believe this person, if you look at the facts, was a martyr.
Yeah, it was a combination of both. Some people were acclaimed as martyrs very quickly after their death. Other people, a couple of decades later, someone would say, well, you remember that story? Maybe that's our local martyr. Hmm. And then the story would grow. Our records for all of these martyrs have been edited by later generations of scribes. And sometimes they were only written down for the first time hundreds of years later. So that causes a real problem for us in trying to ascertain what actually happened. And then, and this is really intriguing, there are these instances of people dying as martyrs, and early Christians will say, well, they weren't martyrs. Because they were heretics, or because they were schismatics, or because later Christians didn't like them. So sometimes they would be sort of pushing to one side martyrdom stories about people that they didn't like.
Candida Moss is my guest. She's professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. Her new book is called The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Candida Moss. She's professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. She's also author of the new book, The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Candida, you're not arguing here that there never was a Christian martyr, but simply that there was not a systemic pattern of persecution against Christians from the very beginning up to modern times. For the martyrs that can be believed to have existed, can we trust the accounts that talk about, you know, their specific words or things they might have said?
Right. Well, this is tricky because so many of these texts have been edited, and when you actually look at the evidence, it seems that words have been inserted into their mouths that they couldn't have said because those ideas didn't exist yet. I would say we can say that these martyrs died, And persons of faith can believe that these people said these things and that they were martyrs. I think where we cannot make historical claims is the motivations and actions of the quote-unquote persecutors. You know, that's where we have to stop. We cannot say that Christians were constantly persecuted. And that's the idea that's sort of dangerous today, the idea that we're being persecuted and there are people out there who are out to get us. But we can still regard people as martyrs, and we can trust that they said something like this, if not the actual words that are ascribed to them.
Why do you think that Christians, let's just take the United States as an example, why do you think that American Christians, and certainly not all of them, but you know, a significant minority perhaps of American Christians truly do perceive a sort of overall persecution from the broader population, maybe from the secular population? Why is this something that remains not simply part of history, but something that people feel in a contemporary sense?
Well, you know, Christianity for so long really was the dominant cultural force. It really did get to call the shots on how society was run. And I think that at the same time we have this persecution idea that's really hardwired into Christian identity. So when Christians have been powerful, they've identified just dissenters within their own ranks as persecutors, because that's how ingrained it is into the Christian psyche. I think that when it comes to Americans today, this is sort of a very easy default mode for Christians to go into. The idea that when people are disagreeing with us in political contexts, when people want to change the social structure of society, when they want to change the way society is organized, that this isn't just a difference of opinion. This is, in fact, persecution. And because we're seeing people, be it, you know, sort of secularizers or liberals or whoever you want to name these people, challenging what has been the Christian status quo, it's very easy to read that as persecution. But if we can put aside the idea that we're constantly under attack and that any disagreement is necessarily persecution, then we have to really engage why people want to change things. And we have to start trying to persuade people that our ideas are correct. And that goes for everyone, no matter what religious or political group they speak for. That's sort of what democratic society is about. You're supposed to be trying to persuade people. You're supposed to be trying to run society in a way that people agree is good. And so I think that's why people are responding in this way, and I think this is how people need to change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Rockwall. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Here's my question. I'm fascinated by this this book, but I was also fascinated by a book by another professor at University of North Carolina. His name is Bart Ehrman.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems as though there's a number of books along these lines that really go to the heart of a lot of the stories that are actually inherent in the quote-unquote Holy Bible, the quote-unquote New Testament. So it's kind of like the question in my mind is, why and what are you to make of this when people, you know, especially people like, for instance, a number of evangelicals who believe in this country that the Holy Bible is the undisputed Word of God, when in fact there's so much dispute about it.
Well, maybe you could talk about that, Candida, as a scholar, about how scholars who are also people of faith sort of rectify looking at things with a critical eye and also, in many cases, embracing texts as sacred.
Right. I personally think that looking at the history, looking at the historical evidence can actually be a help to people of faith. You know, there are things in the New Testament about slavery and about the Jews being the sons of the devil. And this is actually how I got into the field. When I read the Gospel of John, in which Jesus calls the Jews the sons of the devil, I knew that just couldn't be right, and I wanted to know how that was in the Bible. So I actually think that history is a place, and looking at the historical evidence is a way in which people of faith can sort of develop interpretations of the Bible that are maybe more morally responsible, ethical readings. We need to confront the problems in the New Testament. We can't just ignore them.
Can you talk about this, the idea that Christianity today, can? Do you feel as if it can survive without these martyr stories taken to the same degree of literalism that perhaps they have been in the past?
I think that Christianity can survive. I think that what will change is the way people talk about themselves in the world. I think there'll have to be a shift from digging in heels and saying, you know, people are under attack, we need to defend our territory, and a move towards persuading people what's good about Christianity. That's a hard transition to make because Christians haven't had to do that recently because they've had the cultural power. But this is a transition that Christians have to make in order to persuade people that what they're doing is right.
Do you think it's helpful to remind Christians that there are other faith traditions that to this day feel as if there are holy martyrs operating in the world and that we may, you know, some Americans may disagree with those perceptions?
Yeah, I do think so. And I would add that there are Christians around the world who are persecuted, too. And instances of persecution, that demands our attention and our action. And this is in cases where people are dying, where there's violence. You know, it really shouldn't matter whether or not that person shares your religious beliefs. You know, this is a question of human rights, and as human beings, we should try to end systems of persecution around the world.
Back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Isaac in Fort Worth. Hi, Isaac.
Hi, my name is Isaac. I'm also a priest. I'm Father Isaac. One of the things I heard, which I found interesting, is directly relating the idea of editing with control. You know, journalists have to have editors. They don't turn in a first draft ever. I hope not. And that seems to be a normal part of the process of storytelling. What exactly, Candida, is your problem with there being editors, given the fact this is part of best practices in a standard of journalism for today?
Right. I don't have a problem with there being editors. I really don't. And I think that particularly, given ancient historical standards, inventing speeches, for example, was very common. That was best practices in history. So I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with taking obviously edited texts that have portrayed the Romans as being much more venomous than they were. And we can actually see that. There's one early Christian martyrdom story that we have three different editions of. And one of the things that changes is that the Roman judge goes from a very civilized philosopher through to sort of a barbaric, demonically inspired persecutor in these three editions. I don't have a problem with people editing texts, but if we then end up saying that historically the Romans were inspired by Satan and cruel and vicious, then we're basically going with the perspective of the third editor, and we're not preserving the historical details.
How does this material, when you present it to your students, are you teaching mostly undergrads?
I teach undergraduates and graduates.
Okay. So for the ones who haven't been introduced to ideas like this before, what does it take for them to sort of get their minds around looking at things they have taken as, if you'll pardon the pun, gospel truth in the past?
Mm-hmm. Well, initially they're shocked, sometimes they're horrified and angry, sometimes they're angry at me, but this is something where we have to look at the material. It's tough to realize that there are things in one's religious tradition that aren't true. That's a difficult realization to come to, but at the same time, if you are going to be a person of faith whose faith is built on sort of strong foundations, you need to look at the history, you need to address the evidence, you need to come to a position that can address these challenges. And so usually by the end of the semester, they're pretty happy with what they've learned.
Talk a little bit about sort of newly created martyrs and the way that this tradition of declaring certain people who have been killed as martyrs continues today.
Yeah, well, sometimes it just happens. Sometimes someone will die and they'll just be acclaimed by the local community or by the press as a martyr. when the Catholic Church makes someone a martyr, there's sort of a very thoroughgoing process. There need to be miracles. Their life needs to be examined. But often even the process of just deciding who's going to be treated as a saint is itself quite historically shaped. So in the 60s and 70s, in response to feminism, a number of Catholic saints were acclaimed who were women who had died as a result of rape or in childbirth, and they were acclaimed as saints because they represented traditional views of women within the Catholic Church. And it's not that they weren't saintly people. They were saintly people, but the reason that they are acclaimed, even today, is often shaped by political and historical currents in that time.
Is it inherent in the definition of a martyr that one has to have the power somehow to sort of choose life or death? In other words, if one would renounce one's beliefs, you'd be able to sort of walk away.
Right. And this really depends on who you ask. A lot mm-hmm. of people would say, if you don't have the choice to walk away, then that's just murder.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a tragedy, but it's murder. On the other hand, people would say, well, we wouldn't want you to choose too much, or that would be suicide. Martyrdom occupies this very uncomfortable space between just murder and suicide. Historically, people have been called martyrs who did not have a choice, and they have been treated as martyrs anyway. And it really depends on who you ask.
Do you see churches dealing with martyrs in a different way in the modern era, or did you write this book specifically because you don't see any shift?
I wrote the book because I saw people using this language of persecution today, and it seems to me that what's underwriting it is this misunderstanding about early Christian history and prophecies made by Jesus. I have been to lots of churches and heard people talk about martyrs as examples, which is probably how people should use martyrs as examples. I think people are more reluctant to encourage people to embrace martyrdom today, and I think that's probably a good thing.
Are there things we can do in the broader culture, even outside of any particular religious tradition, to sort of take the emphasis off the value of martyrdom to the extent that it can get in the way of multilateral dialogue?
Right. I do think that everyone needs to ratchet back their rhetoric. You know, we all need to step back and be reasonable in our discussions. And even non-Christians who are living in America are sort of heirs to this idea. Before Christianity rose to power, when people said that they were persecuted, that wasn't a claim that actually had much authority. It's only now, because of Christianity, that we think that persecuted groups have sort of special status. They have the moral high ground. Previously, they had been abandoned by their gods, or their gods weren't powerful, or they had sinned. So I think we're all heirs to this tradition, and we all need to look at the facts, try and empathize with the arguments of our political opponents or social opponents. We all need to sort of try and understand the perspectives of others.
Candida Moss is professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame. Her new book is called The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. Candida, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.